Hello. Thanks for having me. This talk, you know how sometimes you think, I've got to finish that paper and so I'm going to schedule a talk. And then that way I'm sure to finish the paper by the time of the talk. And then as the talk comes, you say, well, I'll give the talk and then it'll scare me into finishing the paper. So that's the mode I'm in right now, scaring myself into finishing a paper, myself and my collaborators. So I'm going to talk about stuff that we, and this is very informal, so interrupt me, and I'm bound to say things that are slightly incorrect, so please start yelling at me. I'm going to talk about an attempt, so first I should say, this is work done with Peter Graham and Surjit Rajendran. And this all came out of an attempt to solve the so-called hierarchy problem of particle physics. And I'll remind you all, or explain to you all what that is, briefly. And as part of it, I also should give a very brief introduction to standard cosmology. So I'll introduce that. And then I will talk about something interesting we discovered about the standard model of particle physics, which is if you add a single field, its vacuum structure, and a couple of interesting couplings, its vacuum structure becomes very interesting and possibly is pointing to something like a solution of the hierarchy problem and other things. And then I will talk about attempts to solve the cosmological constant problem, which led to a possible bounce solution of the universe with reasonable matter. And we'll get to what that means. If you add truly crappy stuff, you can do anything you want. So the goal was to add non-crappy stuff and try to get interesting cosmology out of it. The hierarchy problem in the standard model is a list of particles and their couplings, and the last particle discovered directly is the Higgs, and we label its mass by m sub h, and its mass scale, the parameter that actually lives in the classical Lagrangian is mass squared. So there's some mass scale for the Higgs particle. It's 125 GeV. And the rest of the standard model lives here. There's only one over there. I get the left and right. And the Higgs is responsible for the fundamental, what appears to be the fundamental mass scale of the standard model. The Higgs is a field, and its potential energy looks, in two of its components, like the bottom of a wine bottle, and its minimum energy, therefore, is displaced from zero, and because of the way it interacts with other particles, it gives masses to W and Z gauge boson, and most or all of the fermions of the standard model, the quarks and the leptons, possibly the neutrinos, certainly the neutrinos at some level. And the mystery or the sort of unnerving feature about the Higgs in the standard model is this term, which appears in the field theory standard model. The Higgs is a complex field, a representation of the gauge group of the standard model. And its mass term appears to break no symmetry in the theory. And the reason that's important is because when you calculate quantum corrections to it, your naive correction is divergent. So there are divergent contributions to this mass. And divergent means it's cut off by the ultraviolet physics at some scale lambda. Let me call it M, actually. And so there's a natural mass scale you would associate with the Higgs, which is the scale of the ultraviolet physics where the standard model is no longer valid. And so the assumption has been all this time, or for a long time, that this is a great hint suggesting that M is not too far from the physical mass of the Higgs. And the new physics, the energy scale of the new physics, should show up when we discover the Higgs. And it didn't. And where it would have shown up is indirect measurements of the low energy particles of the standard model and tiny corrections due to the new physics. And then more directly at the Large Hadron Collider, it should have shown up when we pushed the energy, discovered the Higgs boson, and perhaps the other particles. The most famous of these possibilities is supersymmetry. But even after discovering the Higgs, you could imagine the Higgs boson is a composite, as say a pion, things made of quarks. Perhaps the Higgs is made of also things, and those excitations of those smaller bits, higher energy bits, would show up at the Large Hadron Collider. They have not. So you'd say that the Higgs is here and there should be new stuff right above it. Really, realistically, some of it should have dribbled below. And we've been suspicious that there's something wrong with this energy scale for a long time. First, because of something we call naturalness, or the hierarchy problem, and then the fact that no indirect tests of standard model physics has given us any sign of anything beyond the standard model. The bigger hints beyond the standard model are things like dark matter, something that makes the universe homogeneous, a cosmological constant, and possible hints of the unification of forces. But no experimental hints associated with known particles that show off subtle differences from what we'd predict from the standard model, and nothing at the LHC. And so the approach to understanding this scale, beyond simply saying, well, it's a parameter in our theory, it may not look very nice, and even though I can't figure out what high energy physics would produce it, perhaps the universe is fine-tuned. I would say broadly, people have thought about cosmological solutions to this problem. What I mean by cosmological solutions is some evolution in the early universe that fixed this problem, that there may have been a natural scale for the Higgs mass to be very large, and that natural scale is much greater than the physical mass we measure. But because of the evolution of the universe and where we landed, perhaps, we see a Higgs which is very different from what might be construed as its natural value. And cosmological solutions then suggest that there are many options for what the Higgs could look like, and we landed in the one where the Higgs is very light compared to its natural scale. And so the first cosmological solution is the anthropic solution. The anthropic solution is simply the statement that the Higgs mass could depend on some field, some other variable which itself can have a potential, can change. And if that field has some potential and changes, then you can imagine that there are different minima, metastable minima, local minima in that field's potential. And in each one of these minima, there may be a different value for the mass of the Higgs, since there's functional dependence here. And so here, the Higgs mass is something, mh equals, well, mh1, mh squared 2, 3, etc. What I mean by the mass of the Higgs, of course, is a parameter. It's the quadratic term in the potential for the Higgs. So the mass of the Higgs is this term in the potential. And it could take either sign. Again, it's just a parameter. When it is positive, the mass of the Higgs is positive, and that means its potential doesn't have this shape. The potential has a minimum at zero. So in the places where the mass is positive, the potential predicts that the expectation value of the Higgs field will be zero. And there, the Higgs mechanism does not occur. Masses are not produced for the standard model particles via the Higgs mechanism. In places where the mass of the Higgs ends up negative, then you do have this shape. And the minimum is not here. It's not that the Higgs has a negative mass square. The field has negative curvature here at the origin, and therefore it finds itself very quickly in its minimum, or one of its minima. And here the Higgs mechanism works. But the typical value for all these masses, magnitude, is of order the typical contribution, which is this capital M squared, some high energy scale where the new physics really is, and the LHC can't afford to get to it. Energy, it doesn't have the energy budget for it. So then you could ask, if you have enough of these vacua, could you have a vacuum where the Higgs mass of either sign is parametrically smaller or accidentally much smaller than the capital M where all the new physics is? And of course, if you have enough vacua and they're finally spaced enough, sure, some of those vacua you would expect would have parametrically small masses. And then the only question left is, why do we live there? And the why do we live there piece is a statement about how do we populate this landscape of possible vacua? And the assumption that we live here because we could only live here, that all these other places where the mass of the Higgs is much larger, they're unlivable. They don't produce the complexity necessary that you would produce in this minimum. And so you need a big hierarchy of scales. Oh boy. Sorry about that. It was a red eye flight. All right. You need this complexity, this difference in scales to produce all of the complexity we have in our life. Lots of chemistry, lots of isotopes, the kind of things that produce chaotically very complex beings like us. Not complex enough. So this is one scenario. It's a bit interesting. I mean, it's certainly possible, and it's depressing in the sense of it seems plausible that one can never test this, that we live truly separated from these other vacua. You can also imagine that these other vacua are behind horizons for eternity, and so we've never interacted with them. And then you can ask broader questions about, are those vacua really in the theory? So then you have to talk about initial conditions. And how do you decide what the initial conditions are? The nice thing that's been understood is that if you include in this story, you're thinking about, of course, populating, going from one vacuum to another, you think about those transitions in terms of energy. And so you need to know the effects of gravity as well, because in principle, that affects the transitions. And so if you have different minima, then you can have transitions and will have transitions eternally if the vacuum you start in is eternally inflating. Eternally inflate means that if a vacuum has very large vacuum energy and it lasts long enough so that it expands more than its own size in a Hubble time, or in many Hubble times, such that these other vacua are not produced, then once they are produced, like a phase transition might occur in bubbles of vacua 2 and 3 and 4 might be produced, then if these bubbles can't collide due to the causal structure of the universe, they're expanding away from each other too quickly, then you never transition completely out of this state, and in fact you populate all of the states. If some of the states are below zero energy, they approach, in principle, anti-de Sitter space. Such states could, bubbles could collapse in its interior, although the bubble itself doesn't disappear. And so there is a way with this eternal inflation to populate all of these different vacua, and what you then depend on is an argument about why we live in a special one, let's say an aberrant vacuum, and that is the anthropic principle. So the thing we tried to figure out was, can you avoid using the anthropic principle? Can you have many choices for the different vacua, and can you land in the correct mass of the Higgs, the parametrically small mass of the Higgs, in a way that's dynamical and not forced on you, or where you're forced to make a statement about where we could survive? And so what we wanted to produce was something like this, where a particle or a field takes on some value which is not at its minimum when the universe is very young or at very early times, and that field value, its expectation value, slowly changes in time, and it changes in time with enough friction that when it sees a first barrier, it gets stuck there and it doesn't move. And so if the Higgs could be such that it's a special place where the Higgs field has a tiny mass and it just turns on at that time, then you can imagine a reason why the potential for this field could change and you could get stuck there. So let me... Is Neil here?
No, you're safe.
You've got emotion.
Oh, good. So I can talk about inflation.
Yes.
Great. Okay. So I just
really want some of us to channel this.
What?
You're recording.
Sorry, Neil. Okay. Review of inflation. There's a lightning review of inflation. What is inflation? Inflation is the idea that you can make the universe homogeneous using a scalar field that is dominated by vacuum energy most of the time. And so a scalar field, first, you should know the Friedman equation. I assume you all do. And you should know the second Friedman equation, which you do, and I can't remember what it is. I just always get the coefficients wrong. It's
minus 4 pi g.
I knew somebody here would know it. And is it rho plus 3p?
That's right. Yeah.
Thank you. Fantastic. Okay. So the review of inflation is that you have some field. Here, let's give it a very simple potential, mass of 5 pi squared. It is a potential. It looks like this. The value of that field at some time early in the universe in some area in space in the little neighborhood is some large value, and you ask, what are the equations of motion of this field? And in an evolving universe with this Friedman equation, equation of motion of the metric, you have an equation of motion that looks like this, and you have a friction term. And so this is a harmonic oscillator with a friction term, and the question is, when are you critically damped? And it turns out you're critically damped as long as the Hubble scale is larger, the Hubble rate of expansion is larger than the mass of the field. I don't know what colloquia means here at PI, but I use h bar equals c equals 1. Everything is 1 except g Newton. It's a particle physics thing. So that means that some, it turns out some large enough value where the vacuum energy is very large. Vacuum energy potential, rho, is kinetic plus potential, and pressure, in this simple case of a uniformly rolling field, is the kinetic minus potential. And so if you have a situation where this vacuum energy is dominating, then the Hubble scale, which is this, the rate of change of the expansion or of the scale factor of the universe, this Hubble scale then is proportional to something which is dominated by the vacuum energy. And the solution to this equation, where the pressure is negative, the energy density, you find positive acceleration, and the universe accelerates. And accelerated expansion also allows this friction term to dominate. And this is not a harmonic oscillator. It's something falling with drag. And so it's at critical velocity. And so this slow moving velocity, which is subdominant in the energy, makes us look like we live in an exponentially expanding universe, namely something close to De Sitter space. And that stretching out of the universe makes the universe very homogeneous. And structure in the universe is predicted to come from inflation, because the universe is expanding so quickly. Sometimes we write as for a fixed Hubble size. So we have a Hubble rate, which means 1 over Hubble is a Hubble time. And since c equals 1, this is also a Hubble distance. And so this roughly a Hubble patch is the causally connected parts of the universe. And the space-time, the coordinates, are flying out of this Hubble patch as it's exponentially expanding and things are decoupling from each other. And quantum mechanically, if you have any fields, and we do have this scalar field, that field has quantum fluctuations, and those quantum fluctuations leave the horizon. And so what happens in inflation is in different patches, in different Hubble patches, there is classical evolution, but then there's quantum fluctuations around its classical expectation value. And those fluctuations give you perturbations in the energy density. So that sources the cosmic microwave background and eventually the structure of all matter. That fluctuation, that initial condition for the density, energy density perturbations in the universe, has been measured to be roughly 10 to the minus 5, or 1 part in 10 to the 5 fluctuations in the energy density with respect to itself. And that gives you a sense of how big the average fluctuations are as you're rolling down here. In fact, the fluctuation size, delta phi, the fluctuation size of the field, you can show by computing that two-point function is of order the Hubble rate itself. The classical rolling time you can get from this equation. If you assume that the acceleration is ignorable, then you can solve for phi dot. Phi dot is v prime over h. And so what you want to know is, in a Hubble time, how far do you roll classically compared to how big are your fluctuations quantum mechanically? And what you find then is classically, in a Hubble time, so we multiply phi dot by a Hubble time, which is 1 over h. This is the classical evolution. We'd like the classical evolution to be larger than the quantum fluctuations, which is h cubed there over v prime. This is, in fact, roughly generates delta rho over rho, and we'd like this to be less than 1. Why would we like it to be less than 1? If the quantum fluctuations are too big, then there are patches of the universe where the fluctuation upward dominates, and that part of the universe is inflating, but inflating longer. And with the exponential expansion of the universe, you leave traces everywhere of parts of the universe that never end inflation. So you're eternally inflating in that case, and you populate all possible vacua in the case where you have eternal inflation, meaning the case where this bound is not satisfied.
In that regime, do you have a, people frequently say this, but it seems to me that calculation is not remotely under control in that regime. Do you disagree?
I do not disagree.
Okay.
It's not remotely under control in that regime.
Okay.
But you people have carefully calculated the phase transition point, the place at which the slow roll parameter, which just measures the essentially the slope of this as a function of the other parameters, when that's they've been able to calculate it. This is Cremonelli et al. A phase transition at that point that shows when inflation lasts either a finite time or an infinite amount of time. And that calculation appears to be under control. I certainly can't reproduce it.
Okay.
But they can prove there's a phase transition, and surprisingly, they can even, using tools like effective field theory of inflation, they can surprisingly even accurately predict what that number is.
Keep going.
Sure. But I'm not wedded to eternal inflation, luckily. But this is where we live now in terms of the understanding. So then what we wanted to figure out was a way to first make this a special point where the mass squared of the Higgs, the magnitude, is much smaller than the typical scale associated with the physics of the Higgs. And of course, we want it to be negative so that it can get this Higgs effect. And the third piece is we need friction, because you don't want to start at some random initial condition and find yourself here with so much kinetic energy, you go flying off over the barriers. And so what we had discovered was there was a field that produced this sort of coupling and this sort of accident, that you can have barriers become important when the Higgs is parametrically light. And that coupling, you take some field and you couple it to the field strength of the strong interactions. This is known as an axion coupling. And we took advantage of that, but we're not pretending the axion is coming from something that makes this a Goldstone boson. We just asked this to be a pseudoscalar and have this coupling, and we add only one additional coupling, namely a coupling directly to the Higgs field. And so this coupling, what it produces is, as phi evolves, of course, the mass of the Higgs, the physical mass of the Higgs evolves. And so this was exactly what we wanted. The miraculous piece of this is the fact that the Higgs and its expectation value controls these barriers. It turns out that this interaction at low energies, when the strong interactions become strong, can be written as a periodic, I shouldn't use F. Oh. Let's call this F phi. It's some periodic function in phi with period 2 pi F, little f. And this periodic function, its magnitude, depends both on the QCD scale and at leading order, the mass of the lightest quark in the standard model. So this is a simplification, but what this means is when the Higgs has a vacuum expectation value, that vacuum expectation value can create quark masses and change the height of these barriers. And so if you are living up here, and up here the physical mass of the Higgs is positive, there's essentially no contribution to this axion potential. And if you cross some line where the Higgs mass goes through zero and then becomes negative, you have this shape for the Higgs potential, and the Higgs ends up rolling, producing a vacuum expectation value, giving a mass to all of the quarks, including the up quark, and producing a barrier height, which now depends on the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs. And the point is that we need this slope to be very gentle anyway. So parametrically, we have to match this slope to the height of the barrier that we want. And if we match the slope and the height of the barrier, then we determine where the Higgs ends up. So we're not predicting what the mass of the Higgs is, but the mass of the Higgs now depends on parameters which are completely different than capital M. It depends on parameters such as the slope and the height of that barrier. And the height of this barrier, we know what we want to end up with because we know the scale of the strong interactions, and we know roughly the mass of the up quark, the current mass of the up quark. And so that gives us a target of what scale, what this slope can be, how long it has to roll before it gets stuck at that point. So this became then a possibility of, I mean, first let me say, just the fact that you can add one field to the standard model and produce this sort of vacuum structure such that there are vacua right at the edge in this transition region which have very tiny Higgs masses, we find very interesting. A common concern is you are here, and now let's remember the cosmological constant. The cosmological constant tells you whether you're inflating or not inflating. This whole period of rolling, this field is essentially playing the role of the inflaton. When you get to the end of this thing, you have to decide what the cosmological constant is. You can choose to fine-tune the cosmological constant to zero. It's an unfortunate tuning, but you could tune it. And if you do, then fine, you've reproduced the vacuum that has the right Higgs mass. And with the tuned zero vacuum energy, it's no longer eternally inflating. Now, we believe we are inflating. We are expanding at an accelerated rate. We don't know if that's cosmological constant driven. There could be a field that's rolling and eventually rolls us down to a different vacuum or to anti-de Sitter space. But you might be concerned that if vacuum energy is non-trivial here, that you can get these eternal inflation transitions to all possible other vacua. And so you have some necessities about what this vacuum should be, that really it should end up at zero before you start populating anything else. If you try to make arguments about time, well, we're here for such a long time because these transitions are so rare. If we last an infinite amount of time, you can't make arguments like that. There are other arguments you can make to try to support this, but really where we ended was the decision that we have to solve the cosmological constant problem. And we want to do it without the benefit of using the anthropic principle and saying we couldn't possibly live in a place where the cosmological constant is big.
So can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So this phi field, it's supposed to be light or?
It's very light in this context, yes.
So, and it's because of the shift symmetry that it remains light?
Yes.
But then that phi h squared term breaks the shift symmetry, so.
Yes. This term breaks the shift symmetry. Correct. Exactly. So you should add terms that you would get. You calculate loops, and they're divergent, and they're cut off by that scale that cuts off the Higgs. So you can estimate what the size of that slope should be.
Uh-huh.
But they're still proportional to the coupling that does the explicit breaking. And so G, that coupling, is the thing that controls the size of the breaking of the shift symmetry, and it controls the size of that slope and the potential.
but M can be, I guess, Planck mass or something.
M can be Planck mass in principle, as long as you can satisfy all cosmological constraints. It turns out that M can't be quite the Planck mass in this case, because we have our eternal inflation constraint on this rolling part. And so we put the constraint that h cubed over v prime is less than 1, that constraint alone, and wanting the barriers to stop the rolling field, and knowing that the vacuum energy is at minimum this much, putting all those constraints, you find you can't live with a cutoff bigger than 10 to the 7 GeV. And then you discover for this particular field that you predict the strong CP phase, the electric dipole moment of the neutrons is order 1, which is 10 orders of magnitude too big experimentally. But there's a very easy fix to that, which is you could tune the Higgs not to its correct value, but you could tune it to 10 orders of magnitude smaller. Then the Higgs is too light. The slope of this potential is flat enough that its contribution to the CP phase turns out to be very small. And then at some later stage, something else in the universe changes, some other field changes, to move the Higgs up to its correct value. It's very easy to get a particle which is fine-tuned to be too light to end up at a heavier value. And so there's an easy fix in that way to solve the strong CP problem with this field as well. But in that case, it turns out the cutoff, this is TeV. That would be very disappointing. OK. So in the simplest model, it's 300 TeV. Then we have model building tricks. What if you have an axiverse of that? We can roll multiple times, and you could push this up to perhaps close to the gut scale. Anyway, but that's model building games. I'm sort of fascinated by the fact that this lives in the standard model with just one extra step. But the real desire is to solve the cosmological constant problem. And the cosmological constant problem is, in a sense, of the same type as this. It's just more robust. Let's see. Page 2. I'm racing. Okay. In fact, this model was written down in 1984. At least that picture was drawn in 1984. This is called the Abbott model. Abbott tried to solve the cosmological constant problem. After slow roll inflation was discovered, he quickly thought you could allow the cosmological constant to relax itself to a tiny value. And it's an incredibly simple idea. The idea is that there is some field, and it has a linear coupling. I've changed the dimensions of G or set M to 1. There's some linear field, and this field also couples to not the strong interactions, but some new group. HH dual of some new group. And the point is that the confinement scale of this group called H, is of order Hubble today. And the idea was that this particle, the expectation value of this field, would roll down its potential in the early universe with very large vacuum energy, rolling extremely slowly. And these barriers wouldn't appear because the Hubble scale at this time was much larger than the confinement scale of this strong force. And so since the Hubble scale is much larger, the time scales were much faster, the curvature of the universe was much bigger, and these configurations were no longer dominant. They were very weak, and they did not produce large barriers. You could also think of it in terms of the fact that a large Hubble scale means a large temperature. And so up here, there's a Hawking temperature which suppresses the production of these special non-perturbative effects. And so the idea was that if the non-perturbative effects appeared when the Hubble parameter was correct, let's call it V naught, which means the vacuum energy today, the barriers appear and you get stuck. And there were two problems with this model. First of all, let's say when this field confines, it's a periodic potential. Let me just write it as cosine of phi over f, lambda to the fourth. So there is some periodic potential that is produced here. And for that periodic potential, for it to stop something rolling where the slope is g, you want the slope of this potential to be larger than this slope. So the slope of this potential is of order lambda to the fourth over f, and you need that barrier to be larger than the slope g. You also don't want eternal inflation. You don't want to be classically rolling down, but quantum mechanically basically populating this entire slope, fluctuating all over the place. Most of the universe, whatever that means, is stuck way up there. And so you can fight for a constraint that the effective delta rho over rho, h cubed over v prime, which is of order lambda cubed over g, which is v prime, we want this thing to be less than 1. But from this relationship, we see that this is greater than f over lambda h, which is f over Hubble today. Since this is a higher dimensional operator, it's an operator suppressed by the scale f, requiring this to be less than 1 would be requiring that cutoff of this theory to be less than Hubble today, which is the lowest energy scale we ever deal with. And so that would be terrible, because this theory wouldn't be, you have two choices. One is that the theory wouldn't make any sense if you avoid eternal inflation anyway. You can't even trust it. Or if f is at a high scale, let's say the Planck scale, you're fluctuating all over the place. And the classical rolling description is not a good description. We don't know what a good description is. So in both cases, you end up somewhere where you don't actually know what's happening. But let's say you could fix it. You could do tricks. You could model build your way the hell out of this. In such a way, you do something, I don't know what, and then you get to some point, and you ask, what does the universe look like now? And the point is that the universe is empty. And it's empty because we've been inflating all of this time. So the empty universe problem is because what we want to be sensitive to is the cosmological constant. But what we're really sensitive to is just curvature. And the things that produce curvature in cosmology is everything, all contributions to energy density. And so you're screwed because you have to wait long enough for the cosmological constant to dominate, and then you measure the cosmological constant, U meaning this phi field, the strong interactions, it's measure, oh, it's light enough, and you get stuck there. But now you've inflated away everything else. You've made yourself sensitive to the only thing in the universe, but now it is the only thing in the universe. And how do you get everybody else back? It's all right, we fix it, come back. And that's the empty universe problem with the Abbott model. We want to bring, we want to refill the universe. So how do we refill? Well, that means we want the energy density to increase. Somehow. And here is one of Friedmann's equations. in terms of a perfect fluid, this is rho, as I had before, a double dot over a equals minus 4 pi rho plus 3p. So what do we want? We want rho to increase. I can write one more equation for rho. Pressure, in the case of a perfect fluid, is the equation of state W, some constant, times rho. And rho dot over rho is equal to minus 3 times 1 plus W, A dot over A. So what do we want to have happen? We're stuck here in an inflating universe. We want rho dot to be positive. In order for rho dot to be positive, we see that W has to be less than minus 1. W is less than minus 1. That means the pressure contribution is negative and much larger. The negative of and much larger than the energy density contribution of some fluid that should be driving the universe. And yet here, let's see, does this matter? Yeah, no, I'll just stay there. And in the case of a cosmological constant, W is equal to minus 1, which is negative pressure. When W is less than minus 1, we have something that's very weird, something that's causing the energy density to increase as the universe expands, and something where the pressure contribution to the to cosmology is more important than the energy density contribution. So this, sir, maybe it's possible. In fact, people have written down ideas for things that do this. But they have sicknesses. You can write in principle a theory of a scalar field with a negative kinetic term. And this is, if this is coupled to anybody else, for example, gravity, this is very bad. Something with a negative kinetic term, of course, is a ghost. And spontaneous fluctuations of this ghost at all energy levels destabilize the universe an infinite amount. And so this is bad. But what ghost inflation, ghost condensation is, is a rewriting of this theory, not assuming that phi are the real degrees of freedom, but that you can expand phi around some constant times time, such that the kinetic term for the pi field has a positive sign. And so the excitations around this vacuum, or this solution to the equations of motion, have stable excitations. And so phi, you can imagine describing it as something rolling fast along some potential. Pi is expansion around that moving phi, and is a somewhat normal-looking field theory, except for the fact that you've spontaneously broken Poincaré invariants. But despite that, you have somewhat normal-looking field theory with no ghosts. To this, people have added little pieces of potential. So normally, you demand a shift symmetry associated with phi. Once you add these little bumps, these bumps can cause, essentially, violations of W is greater than or equal to minus 1. You can get things that W is less than minus 1, and the field rolling over these barriers. Now, of course, again, we don't describe it in terms of this phi field because it's a ghost. It's quantum mechanically totally impossibly unstable. So if you describe the theory in terms of pi, the expectation, then to describe some sort of potential like this, you literally need to write the potential as a function of time. And so I find this incredibly unsatisfying. This would be a way of getting energy for nothing, producing energy that can be dumped into the system to then use the Abbott model, possibly solve the cosmological constant problem. But I think it's probably sick. It has a lot of issues associated with it. Black hole thermodynamics, possible issues associated with acausality.
What's the black hole thermodynamic problem?
What's the black hole thermodynamic problem? It's Sergei's paper about it's a perpetual motion machine of the second kind that you can produce using this field because you have a negative energy field that you can produce. It's negative energy with respect to gravitational couplings. So the fact that we've broken time translation invariance to a diagonal between that and the shift symmetry means in the particle sense there's still some kind of energy conservation and time translation invariance, but it includes a shift of this field. And but with respect to gravity, gravity knows you wrote time translation invariance. So I think it's a process where you can produce these negative energy particles easily and grow the black hole. And so it goes the wrong direction. You can radiate things and grow the black hole. It was something like that. My real concern about it is because I don't want to read any papers about ghosts and Galileans, I would like to figure out a better way to solve this problem. I mean, it's important. I don't mean to insult. This was a very interesting thing. I did look at the original paper when it came out. But when you actually want to use it, you start to worry about it. All right, so I think there's a more prosaic solution. And the hint is in the Rey-Chowdhury equation. So let me remind what that is. How am I doing with time?
You're doing fine.
I'm fine.
You have the full 4 minutes. I'm kidding. Go ahead.
Oh. Hey. I'll just assign reading to you all. That's the best thing. What is the Rey-Chowdhury equation? Well, I'm not going to derive it, even though I plan to. You can take
congruence,
thank you, of time-like geodesics. You take your congruence, and in a patch, your congruence are time-like geodesics. Congruence means you pick any point in the patch. It's identified with a single point on a single curve, so the curves don't cross, and you can track these, take stock of these congruences so that you can track what geodesics want to do. Do they want to converge or diverge? And this is the sort of thing that's used in understanding singularity theorems. And so you identify this tensor, B mu nu, as the covariant derivative of U, where U is the tangent vector field of the congruence. Then this contains the information of deviations of the geodesics away or towards each other or around each other. And one can rewrite B mu nu in terms of the trace, the so-called shear, and the vorticity. So this is the trace or expansion this is the shear, and this is the rotation or vorticity. The vorticity is anti-symmetric. The shear is symmetric and traceless. And then theta is the trace of B. So these are all the components. This P is just a projection operator, G mu nu minus plus. I can't remember the sign, so I'll write P mu nu equals delta mu nu plus U U. So you can't, this is just a rewriting of this tensor B mu nu. This is symmetric, this is the shear. It's a symmetric part of this covariant derivative of the tangent vector. It's showing a shear in different directions because it's traceless. It shows shear in different directions than the motion of the particles. And because this is anti-symmetric, this is like a curl, a generalization of a curl. And so this is essentially the twisting of geodesics around each other. And you can use now this piece, you can calculate d theta d tau, where tau parameterizes all of the various curves, all of the geodesics, the time-like geodesics. And calculating this is the thing that gives you Ray-Chowdhury equation. It's in every GR book. And because these different tensors are orthogonal to each other, when you square, when you take the time, well, I won't go through it. It's too late. I've already blown it. Okay. This is a Ray-Chowdhury equation. What is this? This is the time derivative of this trace. The trace is like the expansion. It's the divergence of the lines. So first, imagine all of these are zero. All we have is this term. You can solve this equation by just integrating. And you have 1 over theta is equal to 1 over theta naught plus 1/3 tau. Now, if theta naught is less than 0, what does that mean? That means geodesics are converging. The universe is starting to contract. Then you see that there's some finite value of tau where this thing vanishes and theta becomes singular. And so this, what this tells you is that this space, in the case where this is the only important term, is not geodesically complete. And what's also true is if you include the shear term, then this is still true, but with the sign, get the sign this way, because this is a square, so this is just another negative contribution to this thing. And then you can ask about the following term, and this term R mu nu you can write as that, just from the Einstein's equation. And so what this term ends up telling you is for time-like geodesics, T mu nu minus 1/2 G mu nu trace of T nu, if this is greater than 0, then this contribution also does not keep ingoing geodesics from bouncing back out. They continue to converge because the sign of this is still negative contribution to this equation. Now this condition is the strong energy condition. And so the strong energy condition this condition translates into something very simple. It's rho plus p is greater than or equal to 0, and rho plus 3p is greater than or equal to 0. The strong energy condition is violated by a cosmological constant. So it's not such a painful thing to violate. In fact, we're expecting to violate it all the time. So this actually could have the opposite sign, regardless of this. If the strong energy condition is preserved, you can in fact show that there's also no vorticity if you want a hyperbolic space, meaning if you want to be able to put a metric on the entirety of the space continuously with space-like sheets, time slices, you have no vorticity. But that's only if you preserve the strong energy condition. If you violate the strong energy condition, then you can get the other sign, and you can get time-like curves which are going in to bounce, to go back out. However, you have to also check the light-like curves. And there's a similar equation, Ray-Chowder equation, for null geodesics. It's essentially the same. The only difference, of course, is that the tangent vectors are null. And the hats just mean they're projected onto the space that's the two vector space that's orthogonal to the two null vectors, this one and some arbitrary null vector that you choose. Anyway, if the vorticity vanishes again, then this negative contribution and this negative contribution also says converging light-like vectors converge. What about the requirement here? The requirement here, again, is 8 pi g t mu nu minus 1 half g mu nu trace of t k mu k nu. But now, since these are null vectors, the second term vanishes. And what you get is 8 pi g t mu nu k mu k nu. If this is less than 0, it violates what's called the null energy condition. The null energy condition requires that rho plus p is greater than and equal to 0. So this is something that even the cosmological constant satisfies. So you now need something very weird if you want this term to contribute in a nice way with the correct sign. You need something that violates the null energy condition. So these Galileans, things like this, you can look to see if some weird fields acting very weird, if their instabilities, time scales are not too short, and maybe you can construct something. And so in principle, that could be possible. But if you violate the strong energy condition and not the null energy condition, there's no theorem that says you can't have vorticity and a globally hyperbolic space. And so what we want to take advantage of is the fact that maybe you don't need some crazy matter that violates the null energy condition, but you have matter that gives you vorticity. And so that was the thing we were attempting.
So remind us, you're still trying to fill Abbot's universe. That's your
objective. Exactly, yeah. So at this point, we've even backed off from Abbot. We just said, can we have a bounce without anything too weird? A bounce meaning the universe expands dramatically, and now how do we refill it? And so, yeah, good. So here's Abbot's universe. You roll down, you get stuck somewhere, and it's empty. And you have a tiny cosmological constant. And so our thought was, what if you roll down, you don't get stuck there, you go through some phase transition. So here's a mock-up of something that doesn't work, but it's a toy. where R is curvature, if there's some new field H, and this scale is Hubble today. So if you have a field which is so light, its mass is Hubble today, when the curvature gets down to Hubble today, its mass changes sign. And it rolls off its potential. And when it rolls off, it actually rolls to a negative cosmological constant. So now it has a tiny cosmological constant. And it's rolling. So as it rolls, and this field oscillates back and forth, you have two contributions to the energy density. You have the CC, cosmological constant, which is negative, it's below zero, and then you have a matter contribution, which is this oscillating back and forth.
It's negative and still very, very small.
Negative and very, very small, that's right. And now it's negative, very small, and you have a matter contribution, and as the universe expands, the constant stays constant, the matter goes down until this hits zero, and Hubble hits zero, and A double dot is negative, and so now you start to contract. And so this universe now starts to contract. So the easiest way to add energy to this universe is to contract it. Solve the cosmological constant problem, and then contract back to something which is very energetic, high temperature, high energy density.
Can you stop the contraction?
Right, so now you have to stop the contraction somehow and reverse it. So that is the goal of attempting to use vorticity. How do you use vorticity? To change the sign. We're going to use it to make null curves along with time-like curves divergent without introducing some null energy violating material that causes the Ricciardi equation to come out right. So anyway, that's the goal. That's what we're trying to do. So we're contracting it. We bounce somehow. No singularities. No Galileans or anything like that. That's what we wanted to try.
How about the singularity theorems?
Yeah, so the singularity theorems, once you violate the strong energy condition and you are non-isotropic, then you evade singularity theorems. So you know metrics that have, well, this one has a singularity, but the Kerr metric, for example, is a black hole, but locally, it has vorticity, and the Kerr metric I'm not going to write it all out, but the point of the Kerr metric is that there is a term which mixes time and the angular coordinate. And so this metric is a stationary metric, but not static, meaning the mixing with time means that, for example, you send t to minus t, you flip the sign of that term in the metric. So it's not invariant under time flips. And so this metric has vorticity, but it has local vorticity. And what we want is global vorticity, something which has vorticity everywhere. And so that's a known solution to something, of course, called the Gödel metric. The Gödel metric is homogeneous, but not isotropic. It's just rotating dust. And here's the simplest formulation. It has the same feature. So this is polar coordinates. Sorry, dz squared. It's such a tradition to write these things down. Or what, you know, who cares if it's signed before? You can look up Goodell's paper, it's in there. But anyway, I'm writing it down. And there's the mixing term. It's the same idea. Goodell's metric does have global vorticity, but it is not globally hyperbolic. And what, how that manifests itself is that there are curves with constant r, constant z, and t equals minus alpha phi. And if alpha is small enough, you discover that this entire curve is time-like, and so you have closed time-like curves. So you have serious causality problems here. Now, we could live in a universe with closed time-like curves, but doesn't look like it's going to be easy to construct such a universe with all of the mess that we've made of the universe. And so this is unappealing, and you see that now you've tried to spread vorticity everywhere, and you get this closed time-like curve problem. There are ways to allow the vorticity to die off quickly enough so you don't have closed time-like curves, and in those universes, it dies off too quickly to reproduce what we need in the Rich-Hawtrey equation to get an actual bounce for a contracting universe. So the solution is to use compact dimensions.
And matter will be produced during the bounce?
And matter will be produced during the bounce. What's happening in the contraction is the CC is small. This slope is so gentle that even during this violent crash and re-expansion, there's very little fluctuation along this. So the field configuration of phi doesn't change. This one rolls down. It rolls back up, because now the curvature has become big again and it gets a positive mass. And so what happens as you contract is the matter density gets higher and higher and higher. And at some point, it either needs to thermalize or it needs to decay as its mass is so big into other particles.
Now, what I'm confused about, there is only one scale in Abbot's thing, which is Hubble today, right?
Yes.
So all of these curvatures you're talking about, positive or negative, the CCs are of the order of Hubble.
Yeah, no, we can't. Yeah, so
you can produce, nevertheless, you know, a hot big bang above nucleosynthesis temperature.
The mass of the particle is whatever the curvature is. So when you're contracting, the farther you contract, the higher the mass goes.
Yeah.
And so you're producing it. Exactly. Yeah. You have to wait. But remember, as Hubble gets bigger, the time scales get shorter. So that whole contraction happens in a single Hubble time. I would say.
Our Hubble
time, the one we care about. So eventually the idea was to put it into compact dimensions. So we propose global vorticity in some compact space. So there's some flow in some interior space. A vorticity is a curl. So 1D, one extra dimension, there's no vorticity. Two dimensions, you can have vorticity, but there are vanishing points. You can think of, in this case, in two dimensions, a vorticity as some vector field in 2D. In 2D compact space, a vector field topologically has to vanish at some points. And the places where it vanishes, you don't satisfy the condition in Rich-Hawtrey's equation, and you still expect to get a singularity. So the question is, at what point can you do it? And in 3D, you can. You can take a compact three-dimensional space and put a vector field on it, which is non-zero everywhere. And so that's where we started. And so I'm just going to tell you the solution for T3 is sort of simple and stupid. Let's say that the coordinates are, compact coordinates are theta, phi 1, and phi 2. So here's an ansatz for a metric. It has the mixing term between time and two of the compact dimensions, and it depends on the third compact dimension.
So this is three extra dimensions you introduced?
Yes, exactly. And they're compact. And now we need the extra dimensions to be stable. We need this to satisfy Einstein's equation. So we have to produce energy momentum tensors that can reproduce this metric, essentially. And so the question is, can we do it? And can we do it with something that doesn't violate the null energy condition? And the answer is no, we can't. But the stuff that violates the null energy condition we find that we need is only null energy violating in the internal space. In other words, we know how to violate the null energy condition trivially in internal spaces with Casimir energy. So in fact, we do have a solution for which a large part, there's a large chunk of parameter space where a stress energy tensor, stress energy momentum tensor, which is comprised of a CC, two contributions from Casimir, and a contribution which I'll call the vorticity contribution. So for small epsilon, we've been able to calculate what massless fields and massive fields contribute in Casimir to the energy momentum tensor. And those plus a CC are enough to are enough degrees of freedom such that the final piece, the vorticity, you can check, does not violate the null energy condition. In fact, it doesn't even violate the dominant energy condition. So it's very safely positive. With respect to, with respect to all directions. So there is null energy violation, but it's something that we can manage because we've seen it before. We know how to construct it, and we know that it's stable. And that was really the end goal. What we're doing is we're stealing that null energy violation from the compact space and using vorticity in the compact space to play the role of the thing that bounces us in the Ricciardi equation.
So can you be a bit more, so what type of matter is?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. We have, the question is only what, right now, what conditions do we have on this matter? So this matter, I can tell you,
Can I propose that maybe you convert and then people can stay?
Yeah. And that's the end. Thanks very much.